This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about grief with Chanel Clay. Having covered this theme not long ago with Sophie Savage in a very popular episode that, of course, is very relevant to the times, we wanted to revisit it but look at additional forms of grief. So aside from specifically bereavement, which, of course, so many people are going through, there are also other forms of loss and things that we are missing and things that we are needing to take time to mourn in this strange time we're in, where we don't know how long we're going to be without certain parts of what were our normal life. And so to start off, I've got a definition from the Collins Dictionary that grief is the feeling of extreme sadness. And I like that quote. It covers everything we're going to talk about today, but it also feels a bit non-specific at the same time. And I think that very much reflects how grief can be something really difficult to talk about. It can be so different for each of us. And I guess it's like a lot of those terms that are very prevalent where we can have an idea of what it is, but then you try and explain specifically, like when we've covered happiness. We all have an idea of what happiness is to us, but try and describe that in any concrete way other than maybe not unhappiness, you know, is quite difficult to do.
Yeah, it's relevant to you. All down to your experience and what that means to you. I guess happiness is tricky. Grief gives us a little bit of an idea that it's around some sort of loss, grieving something. But yeah, away from it just meaning, you know, I'm grieving the loss of a person through death, which is generally what people would assume straight away. But I do hear that word a little bit more day-to-day language around different things, especially at the moment. And you know, in relationships. And I watched an interview the other day with a mother of a transgender child, and the mother was talking really passionately about the grief that comes with, you haven't lost your child, but to lose your child that was the child that I, you know, the identity of the child that was welcoming a new person into the family. She said, you know, my child's characteristics are all still there, but I felt an immense feeling of grief that I'd lost my daughter. I felt like I'd lost my daughter. And as much as, you know, and their relationship was great and the mother was supported the child all the way through the transitioning, but there was still a really rich, you know, she was saying it's not spoken about enough. You know, we don't talk about it enough, but she said, I still feel it now. You know, there's a real level of grief, although nobody's died.
That's such a big one, and it's one that, like many types of grief, can be quite stigmatized, right? Because you obviously want to be accepting and supportive, but ultimately it can feel like you're losing a daughter and gaining a son. And if that happened in any other way, you'd really struggle with that. And so, like we talk about in the episode actually quite a bit, there can be so much from acknowledging that and taking the time and being like, okay, it is acceptable to feel this way. And if I berate myself for it, it's going to be worse, you know? And obviously, yes, do talk about it. In that situation, maybe you talk about it more with other people that as opposed to the child who may receive that as a kind of pressure to not transition or that they're not accepted. But no, it's a really good example and one that a lot of people won't think about. One that I think for me, I've been thinking about a lot and I think is affecting all of us in some way at the moment is grieving our pre-COVID life, that I've been really trying to work on that recently, particularly with this lockdown that does feel like more drawn out and vague and never ending. And maybe it should be, you know, that there's not a set date, but instead it's assessed and we see how we go because it is taking a while for those cases to come down. But at the same time, I think in this limbo period, it's been really important for me to appreciate it is okay to be sad for the things I don't have. And you know, all the silly things that pop up that kind of remind me that actually life is harder at the moment. I should be going easier on myself. To give you some insight into my day today, I rushed off to the post office before this, only to be standing in line. They've closed the self-service things, which I miss because I can just whiz through and daydream or listen to a podcast while I'm putting things through. And I had some orders to go out and I instead had to take a ticket and go to a counter. Fine. except I then was daydreaming whilst waiting for my ticket to be called and only realised when the next number was called I'd lost my space. And I thought, and what do you do, right? Because you might like try and go to someone and be like, oh, I think my ticket's been called, or you'd pull another one. And I just thought, no, gonna come back tomorrow. I just try
again. Did you retreated?
I was like, I can get another one and wait here for longer and be frustrated with myself, or I can try and negotiate to still claim my place with someone who realistically none of us want to be near each other, particularly if it's not my ticket called. So I just thought, you know what, nope, this is tomorrow's problem. And then what else happened that was silly? Oh, and then I rush back here. I get all set up to record with you. And I seemingly had mixed up the numbers 1 and 2 because I was rushing to get on a Zoom call that wasn't until 2:30, not 1:30. And that is what I would call COVID brain. And we're just, that's it, right? We're all finding it a bit more chaotic. We're all a bit out of it. I feel particularly in a daze, and it is what it is.
It is, but it's hilarious. I've got a few things to say. Number one, when would you ever talk to me about taking the wrong ticket in a post office queue and then coming home and getting a time wrong? Like, that's the highlight of your day. That's what you've done today. Also, I was thinking to myself, and you know when you said, well, that's tomorrow's problem, one of the things I've been starting to worry about, and I've got to just get it out of my head, worry might be a bit strong at this point, but consider the fact that when I am out for a bit, I've had a really long walk the other day. I think it was about 3 hours I was out, right? And I drove to a nearby park, only a mile away. Hope that's not breaking the rules, but there's a huge park near me anyway. You know what I couldn't wait to do? Get home. Oh. And I thought, that is something, some weird shit, because all I'm doing is being at home. But my friend said she was feeling the same thing the other day. Like, are we going to have the energy when we come out of this to go back to what was constantly, for me, on the go? Always. Now, one thing, and I'm literally like, oh, I'm just ready to get in, have a shower, have my dinner and sit on the settee, you know. So be interesting when we come out of this, the energy levels, like you know, to be like, I can't wait for another ticket, can't be bothered, I'm going home. You might have done on another day because you'd have been going off to meet somebody else for lunch, or you'd have been doing something else, so you'd have thought, well, I can hang out, I can come back or whatever. But it's like this effort, just this effort of doing stuff is starting to make me wonder. So I'll be interested to see what that's like at the end, if there is an end. Because at the moment...
Don't say that. Don't put that on record. No, of course
there will be an end. But I was going to say to you, I'm actually grieving, which I don't really like using the term, you see. So this is when it's interesting, because I think, Dan, that's bullshit. Do not use the word grief to talk about the fact that you're missing school. But I'm grieving the school run, Bob. Now, I don't know if that's a thing, but I am actually wishing, sad. I'm thinking, oh, I'd just love to walk those kids to school now and just go to school.
I think we have morning, to validate morning. It. Yeah, different for all of us. And I think there's this danger of comparison culture of who's got it worse. And actually, we've all got it bad in our different ways. It doesn't have to be about, okay, you've got the challenges of homeschooling. Is that invalidated if somebody has twice as many kids as you? No, like you can't compare these things. And so maybe a healthier way of looking at it is we all have things that we miss. We all have things we're struggling with. They're not comparative. And that's how I'm trying to look at it. Because you know that I'm aware that a lot of mine is silly. And that is part of my privilege. You know, there's been bits that have been really difficult for my mental health. And there's been bits where it's losing my place in a post office queue, low stakes. And I kind of appreciate that. Because for some people, all their stuff is very high stakes at the moment.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. But I think you would have felt my pain more if you had children and that you did the school run, because the irony of it is that my friends and I, my social group, absolutely hate the school run. Like, all we do is moan about the school run. It's just a nightmare, Bob. There's cars everywhere. There's people. You're busy trying to drop your kids off, especially with smaller children. You can't pull in. There's nowhere to go. When the weather's bad, you're dragging the kids. You've got PE bags. You've got it all. Like, the school run, it's a bane. You rush home from work. Oh, my God, school's shutting soon. I'm late for school. You can't pull up. Like, the whole thing of the school run, like, you know, and you shouldn't wish your time away, but we're all like, when your kids are older and they can just make the way to school. The school run is the bane of a lot of people's lives, or my friends anyway. So it's just ironic that I'm grieving it a bit, which shows the signs of the times. Because I just want them kids to just go back to school, you know. But hey ho, I do keep saying we're healthy. It's getting tiring. Grateful for what we've got and think about your privilege. It does get tiring, and I'm not going to say that it doesn't, but it is overwhelming when you really sit and put yourself in that moment of, I am healthy and my children are, and we're all still here. And so as much as every now and again, I just want to moan without, well, my kids are doing my head in, but I do love them. You know, I always put caveats in to kind of show my consideration for others who have got it worse. And that just does get a bit tiring sometimes, because you just want to go, oh, you know, it's all shit. Shit, shit, shit. So yeah, a bit of a balance again.
I love that though, because I think that really links to my ideas around owning your grief, that like it's your responsibility and it's also your right. So whatever your version of it is, you know, and this of course applies around bereavement as well, right? That everyone mm-hmm. experiences that differently. Some people want to be around everyone. Some people like to withdraw and being on their own. Some people can't eat. Some people want to do nothing but eat. It's whatever works for you. And I think it's the same with this. So if the rant is what you need, have your rant. And at the risk of doing a bit of crossover with our other show, Dating Games, that's something that's really been a learning for me through relationships, particularly breakups, has been where I've learned so much about owning that grieving process. And in particular, the idea of closure. I really believe in closure. And I know there's a whole kind of debate about to what extent closure exists. You know, do we get that sort of sewn up, neatly put away in the past things in life? I don't think we do, but I think we can find our own version of closure. So for me, with relationships, that's been prioritizing my version of that. So that might be that I need to like have one last coffee with someone. You know, that might be that, yeah, even if it means like I'm going a bit out of my way or it's going to be uncomfortable, sometimes I need that last conversation and to say a few more things. Or other times it's, you know, meeting up with a mutual friend and having somebody to talk it through with who knows that person. Sometimes it's, you know, having a rant about it to my counsellor. Like, I've got to find what my version of closure is and really just own that, because it's worth a shot and I deserve a shot at it. And what I can't do is let that be the other person's responsibility. It's not up for them to give me some kind of cohesive end to the relationship, right?
Yeah, I really get that. I think that's why grief with bereavement can be really difficult, because especially if it was something that was unforeseen, there's an element of what the hell has just happened to me? Shock, trauma, you know? Where those elements around closure that many people benefit from, as you've just said you do, can't be had necessarily. And I think that's where then the pains sit. But for people, there are rituals and traditions and all sorts of things that they go through.
And it's about that finding the good enough with it. Because, of course, what do we want? We want that person back. And that's not possible. So what do we find instead? You know, we celebrate their life. We talk about them. We make time to organise a funeral, spend time with family. We do what we can to remember them and to mark that in a way that feels sensitive and real to the emotions that everyone's feeling. And so that's something that's really interesting to explore in this episode. In all the different ways that we can experience loss, what can we do? Particularly at the moment, we're at home with our thoughts a lot. There's a lot of things we're missing. There's a lot of people we're missing. How do we cope with that? So our guest today, Chanel Clay, was so lovely to talk to, so reassuring and comforting, very much directly to me, but also in general, in talking about this. And no surprise, because she's a counsellor and she has a connection to another recent guest, Linnell Plummer, who we talked about military service with. They are both part of Onyx Therapy Group, a wonderful organisation you'll hear a bit about in the episode. And one thing I do want to mention, actually, because you've reminded me with one of your anecdotes, we have a good update since Linnell's episode in that Biden did go ahead as promised and repeal the trans military ban. So transgender individuals can serve in the US military once more.
Oh, I mean, it just makes you think, how could it have ever not been? That's what it brings to me. Like, why are we even now in 2021? You know, like, oh my goodness. But yay, I'm pleased. I knew we would.
Nice to have some good news, as ever. So with that positive note, we'll get into the episode this week with Chanel. Really pleased with it. Really in-depth, broad conversation with someone who's just such a gem and is very nervous about hearing herself back. She's new to podcasts, but I think she sounds great. So please enjoy this episode with Chanel Clay. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. As lockdown 3 drags on, many of us are finding we need some extra support. So this week we've got a quick and convenient option for accessing counselling from home.
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with a licensed therapist in as little as 48 hours. You can choose to schedule weekly video or phone sessions in addition to their messaging service to reach out whenever challenges arise. Plus, with BetterHelp counsellors all over the country, there's a broad range of expertise that may not be available to you locally. And if you don't find the right fit first time, you can easily switch to a different professional free of charge.
To join 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health in this way, just visit betterhelp.com/mentalhealth. And as sponsors of our show, they are offering you 10% off the first month. Visit betterhelp.com/mentalhealth to redeem. That's BetterHelp.com/mentalhealth. Go get counselling. Yeah.
So I am Chanel Clay, and I think the first time that I've ever heard anything related to mental health, I remember riding in the car with my grandmother, and we were in D.C. on our way to church, and there was a guy who was like on the corner, and he was like talking to himself, and so I was like, there's nobody there. Like, who is he talking to? I remember I was really small, and my grandmother was like, oh, there's nobody there that he's talking to. You know, he's lost it, right? And I was like, lost what, right? And so that was kind of like, okay, if I see somebody talking to themselves, then it means that they lost it. It wasn't until later on that's like, oh, that person actually had a mental health disorder, right? And that's the reason why they were having some type of, you know, hallucination, and they figured that somebody was there. So it's wow. Kind of like my first steps of it.
And I think that's a common one. Can you remember thinking back what you might have thought the it was?
You know, when you're like 5, 6, or 7, you think like, oh, that person has a whole imaginary friend. Because you're thinking about, hey, I can't see them. And you hear so commonly that little kids say that they have imaginary friends. So I'm like, oh, an adult has an imaginary friend. And then the older that you get, you start to realize like, oh, okay, it's there definitely was something going on. So I think that's how I kind of cope with it.
Oh, that's actually quite cutely compassionate in a very kid
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And do you remember kind of growing up when these kind of things did come up, although it sounds like they were sort of only briefly mentioned?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, mental health, the terminology itself, I really kind of segued into that when I got into academia. Versus someone actually giving me the proper names for it, right? Like no one is saying this person has schizophrenia, this person has bipolar disorder. It's just more so like they lost it. And so I think a lot of the times parents say that as a way of not introducing their kids to terminologies that they may not be able to express or they don't want to elaborate more on, so more shielding. But I do believe like that kind of went on for a few years. And then maybe when I got into my teens, I started to understand it more.
Was the times then as you got older and you said you started to get into academia, were you also finding it gained more relevance in your life?
Yeah. In transparency, a little bit of self-disclosure. My brother has autism. And so by the time I may have kind of reached my teens, I started to kind of educate myself a little bit more on mental health disorders in addition to, you know, cognitive disorders.
And did you see an intersection with your brother between the cognitive disability and then mental illness?
Yes. I think I saw mostly with the parents who also experienced having someone in their house with a cognitive disability, you know, listening to parents in IEP meetings or, you know, family meetings, right, that were a part of his class, say like they were tired, they were depressed. So I started hearing words like depression a little bit more often. they didn't know anything about the diagnosis or how are they going to help their child. So that kind of like also opened up the experience for me in itself. So it was more of a lived experience that segued into wanting to know more, which then kind of trickled into like wanting to know everything. And I feel like if you always want to keep yourself educated on certain things, then the exposure is there and the opportunity is there. So
for sure. And it's a real lesson in not giving kids the full story doesn't necessarily make them less interested.
Absolutely. Yeah. If anything, it may actually spark their curiosity, right? So I still remember that.
Well, that's true. We're obviously today talking about grief and grief more so in a broad way, because you know so well there's so many different types.
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the most prevalent terminologies is loss and grief, or loss and bereavement. And when we hear these words, we normally associate it to death, dying, and grievance. But there are so many other unconventional types of loss that we don't talk about. And I think primarily, if I want to make it present tense, a lot of the times in this day and age, we avoid talking about those losses because we feel like the most grandiose loss that we're dealing with, unfortunately, on a more prevalent scale, is dying in grief. So we typically far remove ourselves from expressing other types of losses, such as loss of job, loss of opportunity, loss of hope, loss of experience, right? So if we want to talk about how the pandemic may have mitigated how people express their celebrations, like graduations, proms, and weddings, right? So we think about that. But then also, we have some other areas of loss, such as like loss of memory, right? And so we don't talk about those losses. In fact, we actually skip over them too often. And so sometimes it also creates some other issues for us because we don't have the opportunity to process them the way that we would like.
And that's something very relatable to me, because we talked off air about how I've had difficulties with my memory that very much correlate along the lines of when my depression's been at my worst, there's whole parts of my life I really struggle to remember. And so that in itself can be kind of distressing, or can be something that it affects me to the extent where I feel I have to explain it to people. So when I get to know somebody new, I generally at some point feel the need to explain that I have issues with my memory. And it's a difficult thing, because on one hand, you've got the navigating that and having to explain it and try and justify it, which can feel difficult and is also tricky when you don't always remember what you've forgotten. So then someone can be annoyed at me for not remembering something and I'm in the dark about it. But then you've also got the element of going to counselling and working on your mental health. If you're missing some of the pieces, you've got that additional disadvantage.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I like what you said about having to explain to people that there is like some areas of some uncertainty with you, right? And so when we think about that, we sometimes forget that some of the mental health disorders that impact us on a day-to-day basis, such as anxiety, such as depression, have an impact on the brain, right? And our brain is the receiving and the shipping area, if you will, if you think about it in context, when it comes to memory, when it comes to cognition. So if we have stress on our brain, it's a high potential that we are not able to receive, right? Certain events. And we're not able to actually throw out, you know, certain or recall certain memory. So it's very interesting that you also have to explain that. And yes, there are certain people who are not sensitive, right, to those things happening, or they are unaware. Because when we think about memory loss, we think about Alzheimer's or dementia, right, which are two of the biggest ones, because that diagnosis in itself is specifically related to memory loss. It's a neurological disorder. But we also forget that people who have concussions, right? Someone can easily be a football player, have a concussion, or had a car accident and had a concussion. You know, I worked at an elementary school for a little bit, and, you know, our cute little babies are running around on the playground and accidentally hit their head on a playground equipment, or run into each other and they get a minor concussion. That also impacts how they receive information probably for the next couple of days, weeks, or maybe even long term. So yes, absolutely. And that type of impact is kind of referred to as ambiguous loss, which means that it's the loss that someone is not themselves. We talk a lot about how we make this expectation that someone has to remain themselves and remain, I assume, normal, right? Because some of our psychological disorders are not upfront, right? It's not like you have a sign on you that says, hey, I'm struggling from depression, because what people dictate as depression, they're thinking about laying in the bed all day long and not getting up. There are people who function in their depression, right? And so it's very hard to have that conversation that says, hey, my mental health disorder, if you will, also impede some of my memory, right? And so I'm not my same self as I would have been maybe 5 or 10 years before.
And such an important point, because it really speaks to one of the weird societal expectations that we need to both remain consistent in our character and easily understandable to people, because that's what makes us feel comfortable around each other. But then also at the same time, we need to be constantly changing and evolving and improving. And you can't be both things. And within the mental health context, even more so, I would say, because when you go to see people like yourself, wonderful counsellors, there can be weeks when, because of the things you're working on in counselling, you might be feeling worse, even if you're making progress. And so that path is not linear, and it's even more difficult to be consistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The healing process in itself is not linear. And so I think there's a lot of people's expectation for it to be so, right? Like they feel like it's okay, you're getting better, you're rising up. And with loss and grief, if we want to relate it to that, there are instances where you are okay, right? There's days where we are bargaining, right? Okay, well, if I can just remember this little bit, then I'll be happy, right? And then there are times that we feel accepting of it, which is like, hey, you know, I'm not going to remember that. Let me just put it on a post-it just so that I can remind myself. And then there are times where we're upset with ourselves, which is like, how can you have forgot that, right? So we go through these different waves, right? Mm.
Definitely. It's interesting kind of thinking about that in terms of how you can internalize it as well. Certainly the judgment you can feel for the symptoms of your mental illness. I think a very common, whatever your diagnosis is, you can really beat yourself up over those things and it doesn't help. But then also it can feel strangely like the appropriate thing to do when there is such prevalent stigma in society. And to give an example with memory, one thing that I found very tricky with that is that we so associate what we remember with importance. Mm-hmm. And yet we all have experiences of that not being the thing, right? How many times are we really frustrated that we can't remember the one name of the person we need right then? You know, how many times are we losing things like our bank card or our keys? You know, memory is clearly not linear in that way. And yet we have that expectation, so we can judge ourselves for it. But then also I've come across a lot of judgment from other people. And I don't know if it maybe speaks partly to my character, but I can have it where I remember the depth of what someone's told me. So they could have told me about something very upsetting. And I'll remember a lot of the emotive memories, but then I may struggle in that moment to remember their name. It might take me a minute. And that can really offend somebody. And yet, I guess it can feel like the stuff that I need to connect with the most, maybe I am remembering, even if I can't hold everything in.
Yeah. And so what I heard you say is that even when you try the hardest to remember the most, it may be one thing that you forget. And then there's an internal type of feeling where you're like, man, how could I forget that one thing? And so you dismiss all of the things that you remember, right? And so a lot of the times we also have to grant ourselves grace when we are struggling to kind of make our day-to-day normal when we have mental health disorders, right? And so for you, you're like, yeah, I remember the good portion, but I didn't remember that one part, right? And so a reframe of that would be, I remember what I could, which was the majority of the things that they said. Although I didn't remember maybe that one name, I did remember the base of the combo. I did remember the parts of it that was very important to a person. And, you know, sometimes it takes for us to have those combos if we feel comfortable, right? In saying like, hey, you know, sorry, I do have some, you know, struggles with some memory issues. So just remind me of what the name is again. And you have everything else.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is advocacy on your end too, right? Because we also feel, and notice how I stated it, which is I didn't go into depth about my mental health disorder or anything like that, because sometimes we feel like we owe an explanation because of the loss of ourselves too. But in protecting ourselves, we have to make sure that we express things in a way that we feel comfortable too, right? Because we don't want another loss, right? Which is a loss of expression and a loss of freedom and a loss of autonomy when it comes to mental health.
It's funny that the loss of autonomy can lead us to come to quite disempowering conclusions, the threat of that. So for years, I didn't seek any kind of conversation with a professional about my memory issues because I just assumed it was my fault. I thought maybe I'm working too hard, maybe I'm not resting, maybe I'm not sleeping enough. Like I was very confident it must be something I'd done. And in a way, I guess you could argue that's somewhat of a depressive way of looking at it. It's like, of course, it's got to be something wrong with me. But in fact, you know, when it was a big breakthrough for me when I did talk to my counsellor and she explained to me, no, this can be very common with all kinds of mental illnesses. But no, it's an ongoing process. And that's one of the trickiest things. It's just because I don't remember something doesn't mean you're not important to me. And that can be how it's perceived to people. So you've given me some really actually helpful things to think about there in terms of trying to somewhat disconnect from the emotions on that. You know, it is what it is. And removing that judgment, I think, even more than I have is helpful. And then to look at other types of grief, obviously, with the pandemic, there's massive ones around redundancy. And I'll also tie into that in terms of moving home, because they can be quite close. And so could you talk a little bit about the grief with those and how people can approach that?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned loss of autonomy, right? And so loss of autonomy, loss of independence is another one that we rarely talk about. A lot of people have moved home due to the pandemic, right? Sometimes it was just better for people's mental health, right? To be with family or to be with friends. Sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's medical, right? So if you have been living on your own or have been living a specific way for a set amount of time, and then the pandemic happened, right? Which was undeclarable. We couldn't figure out what's going on. We still, at certain times, do not know what's going on. And because of that, a lot of the times people are now feeling bad about their placement, right? Like feeling bad that they had to move home, feeling bad that they are living back at their parents' house, right? Or with a loved one's house. And that loss has to be acknowledged, because when we lose how we operate on a day-to-day basis and it changes dramatically, and we're not talking about a gradual change, right? We're talking about a moving van, let me hurry up and leave, right? Sometimes we don't have time to adjust. If you're used to leaving in and out of your house and now you have to be very careful because you have aging parents and you cannot go and hang out with your friends the way that you used to because you're now responsible for the health of the people in the family. Well, that's a loss, right? Because that's a loss of experience. You know, we joke about FOMO, which is fear of missing out, if anybody has ever heard that terminology. And a lot of people are having that experience and the fear of missing out, the fear of living alone. We're experiencing all of that. So to acknowledge that you actually lost something that, that for some people may be like, oh, you're just moving back in with your parents, it's not that big of a deal, needs to actually be acknowledged, because it doesn't mean that you left your house to go to a relative's house. It means that you actually left a lot of things behind, and the furniture was not the only thing. Your independence may have been left too. Your autonomy may have been left. Your freedom may have been left in that apartment. So we have to acknowledge that we did experience a loss when we had to make those changes.
Right. And I think one of the things that can really hold us back about that is when it is a good move, you know, that we can feel guilty for grieving something if we're like, no, I wanted to move house, or this was a better way for me to cope in the pandemic. This was a good move. You're still allowed to miss the old place. There's still a period of, I think, grieving that's really necessary there.
Yeah, absolutely. So there have been people I know who were like, I had to leave my apartment or I had to leave my state. College students are a very big example of this, right? Because there have been college students who may have been excited for years to move into their dorm. Their dorm opened for about 90 days and they may have closed, right? And they're like, yeah, you got to go back home. They were just getting used to being free, getting used to making decisions on their own, to being autonomous. And then they're like, nope, go back home. And so they also need to acknowledge that there was something that it feels like was taken from them too, because a lot of the things that we have lost in the pandemic seem like they have been taken from us versus willingly given up. So even the example of a person moving back, it may have been involuntary, right? It may have been hard for that person to cope, or may have been hard for them to keep up on their bills. And so, yes, it's a great situation to be around family, but that still doesn't change the fact that they probably still wanted some space. And so they now have to work maybe 10 times harder to recreate space, recreate distance. And so the loss of distance too also goes into that pool of moving and adjusting.
Totally. And I can really see the trauma that can come with change itself. You know, so if mm-hmm. we look at another example like redundancy, there's all the grieving you may need to do about losing that workplace, maybe losing the income, the stability it gives you, the friend group you might have at work. There's all of that to grieve. But also in the change, there can be a trauma. It's like, okay, now I've got to deal with a new group of people, a new office, a new commute. That's all stressful.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so those first 30 days are very important to us. You know, in the clinical world, you know, adjustments that may be very hard in the first 30 days may have some symptoms of acute stress disorder. And then you kind of segue into maybe closer to 6 months, which will be adjustment disorder in itself, right? And then you move past that, and unresolved issues could have some symptoms of PTSD. So we have to think about it too from that standpoint, which is that a lot of the times people have these unconventional grievances and they don't acknowledge it, but it also impacts them on a day-to-day basis. So I appreciate you saying that, because that definitely needs to be talked about more often versus, you know, the whole, okay, did somebody die? Okay, well, that's not a big deal. That's something you can get past. It's like, in this moment, it doesn't feel like I can get past that. In this moment, I'm not processing it well. In this moment, I'm not receiving it well.
I really hate that. You know, the idea of trauma comparison, I just don't believe in, because it's all to do with your personal experience. You know, your mental health is going to be impacted by what is happening to you. So like I often say that, yes, there may be somebody worse off, there may be somebody better off. Actually, neither of them directly have an impact on your mental health to any degree compared to how you're doing.
I think one of the things that you mentioned a few minutes ago, and I took a brief note because it was also on my notes, which was loss of community, right? So I think you gave the example of losing coworkers, and in the midst of these moves, right, especially out of state moves, you lose your community. You know, I mentioned that I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I have my own small set of community here, right? Not extremely big, but I do. And so a lot of people were like, hey, you know, just move back to your home state for the pandemic. You know, you can do everything electronic. But by moving, I'm also losing parts of my day-to-day engagement, right? Like my normalcy, how I move on my day-to-day basis. And so that also was one of the reasons why I decided to stay, right? A lot of other things are moving about, and this pandemic is so uncertain. And so by creating an additional stressor, such as moving, just for some people, they don't want to do that. And these people that we're talking about, they're losing their community in addition to them making this decision, right? That they probably didn't necessarily 100% want to do, but they've done it because it's what works right now. So yes, our communities are broken. We normally meet in person, a lot of our counselors, some of them we have never seen in person, to be honest, that we've even hired up until this point, right? Like we haven't physically seen them, right? And for people whose attachment styles say that they need people around, for people whose love languages, they prefer touch, this is the loss of the things that help them cope is also a part of those unconventional losses that we talk about, which is the loss of support and the loss of coping skills.
And that's massive, that inability to connect as we normally would. You know, I'm a massive extrovert. Mm-hmm. And the longer the pandemic goes, the more I miss actually the really simple things. You know, in many ways, I'm so grateful for podcasting because it means I'm still meeting people week on week. Mm-hmm. But the longer this goes on, the more it's like, you know what? I actually miss the things that I might have overlooked previously, like being sat in a room with a friend I don't live with and actually not talking or watching the TV together or being on a train with strangers and, you know, maybe overhearing a funny phone call. It's all these things that we would never even think that in any way relates to our mental health. And yet with the sort of microscope we've got on that right now, it's so tough. And it can mean that setbacks can feel so much more all-encompassing because we have less distraction. So with the redundancy example.
So I think the first thing is to acknowledge, one, that it's a loss, right? So we've talked about a few losses, but one of the things that keeps coming up as we talk about it is that people are not willing to acknowledge it because they feel bad, right? So step one would definitely be acknowledgement that it is definitely a loss, that is definitely something that you are not supposed to dismiss, that you are allowed to feel, right? That's part one. Part two is, of course, giving yourself grace throughout the healing process, if you will, because a lot of the times we say, okay, well, I experienced a loss, now what? Well, give yourself grace also for the healing process, right? Because it's not an overnight situation. Three, when we are talking about in relation to adapting, think about the things that you need or that can assist you in adapting, right? So if there are things that have been impacted by the pandemic, then part of that adaption plan, if you will, is to incorporate things that you still have access to. You know, the pandemic, as you mentioned, when we do get back to whatever normalcy would look like, we're definitely going to appreciate those overhearing funny phone calls and those train rides and making eye contact with people, because we know eye contact actually creates dopamine, right? Makes us happy. It's like the happy drug.
I didn't know that. Something as simple as eye contact.
Yeah. So have you ever like been on a date or like been with somebody for whatever reason and say that you and the person kind of lock eyes and then you're like, what are you looking at? And you kind of smirk away for that second. It feels weird, right? Like it feels like fairy tale-ish, Disney movie-ish. It just feels awkward. That is actually exchange, right? So that's why a lot of people will say, like, you know, if you notice when people get married, they tell you to look at the person directly in the eyes. It's literally exchange. Most people don't know that. And so a lot of the times through Zoom, but I don't know where your eyes are technically. My camera is up top. You know, your camera should be off to the side. So we don't get the opportunity to exchange the same way that we would if we were in person to create that surge of energy.
That's so fascinating, because I knew obviously it can create connection for you to make eye contact with people. I honestly think that's a big part of why YouTubers are so loved, because they train themselves to look right down the barrel of the camera in a way you're not usually getting with movies and TV, for example. But I did not know there was the dopamine element. It's good to know there's like a serious scientific reason why I'm like getting giggly on dates, so that's good.
Yes, you're not getting giggly on dates. It's probably the reason why kids are watching other kids play with toys for hours. And I know for me, I'm like, what is the big deal? But it's like the kids stare directly at the camera like, hey, we're going to play these games, and kids are getting excited, right? So, and to be honest, that's a coping skill for kids. Like, we're talking about adults too, but that's a coping skill for kids, that they get to see other people play, right? Because they're missing out on play too, which is loss of engagement. So making the plan COVID-proof may make you have to be very innovative. So whether it's going out on the park, taking a ride, right, to also get some sunlight, right, to also, you know, talked about Clubhouse before we got to recording, which is why Clubhouse is thriving so much, which is that people are able to engage with people similar to you and your podcast that they don't know, right? And that rush of meeting new people is also very therapeutic for them. In fact, it can definitely assist them in feeling seen and feeling heard. Because if you're in your house and you don't have access to people, you feel like nobody knows that you are in existence. So Clubhouse is actually medicinal for a lot of people and a lot of other applications, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, if you have boundaries, of course, for each one of those platforms. But it can be very medicinal in that way. Exercising, of course, creating really good, healthy eating habits and ways of engagement, that too, like going to the gym, right? It may not be very long, you may be spread out in the distance, but it also allows for you to see people, right? And so you're like, wow, I definitely see people. So there's a couple of things that come to mind.
And I'm interested to know with that one, actually, of just the importance of being around other people, us all being reminded how important socialization is for our mental health. Is there something that directly happens with that? Like, is there also the dopamine kick of just being around others?
Yeah. So a lot of times people get their dopamine from different places, right? So if we want to talk about just like how seasonal affective disorder is into play and we're in very dark places. I'm in Pittsburgh. It's always dark and gloomy, right? So sometimes I do have to get in my car and drive around and I'm seeing people on the street. And even in those 5 or 10 minute drives that I try to do almost every other day so that I can at least get out, I see people and I notice people and I know that I'm not alone living out this pandemic. And so the same kind of applies for, yes, the gyms and the parks and things like that, because for some people, they need to feel that other people know that they are there and vice versa, that they are not by themselves. And yes, it can be an easy exchange. Somebody knows that I'm here and I feel a little bit better. So I do encourage people to kind of maybe revamp the self-care plan that they may have had prior to and figure out what ways that are safe, of course, that will help them go through the pandemic, which is a loss in itself, right? Because we're talking about all of these losses that have been impacted because of the pandemic. So revamp your self-care plan, ensure that the self-care plan is COVID-proof, and then also grant yourself some grace, right, in the midst of you acknowledging that you're going through some stuff.
I really like that way of looking at it, and it's a great simple way of pulling your mind away from the temptation to look at all the things we can't do, because I know certainly that's become like a symptom of my depression through this period. Okay, when I'm really obsessing over all the things I'm missing out on, that's when I can really spiral. So instead, like you say, if I can try and concentrate on the few things I can do. And I wonder if you get this too, but I find it can be intensely normalizing just going on a walk and seeing other humans, you know, particularly with all the things we're seeing on the news, it can feel very apocalyptic at times. And then you go for a walk and other people are just walking and, you know, living what they can with their life. And that really helps, I think, bring me back down a little bit if I'm getting stressed.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're filtered in a certain way when it comes to media, right? So when we watch the news and there are certain things that are going on, of course, you cut on the news, you're going to hear something about the pandemic. You're going to hear something about the toll that it's taking on people's health, right? So that your anxiety kind of shoots up, right? As soon as you hear, oh, 500 more people lost their lives because of COVID, it's like, oh my gosh, which then also impacts you because you're like, I'm losing hope. So if we go back to loss of hope, I'm losing hope because these numbers are still reaching. Loss of experience, which is I'm definitely not about to go and book that trip to Cancun because, you know, they just had an influx in Cancun, right? The loss of, you know, I'm definitely, you know, one of my friends had XYZ or was around somebody. I'm definitely not about to go out, right? So you start to go through all of the losses that you're already experiencing just by that one 30-second clip of media. And so you do have to ground yourself and come back full circle, which is, well, what are the things that I do have that are remaining? What are some of the things that I'm interested in that I maybe have never tried out, to be honest? You know, I'm hearing people picking up hobbies like, yeah, you know, I actually picked up tennis. And I'm like, tennis? Like, yeah, I mean, there's nobody on the tennis court. You're far from the person anyway. So you're going out there and you're playing tennis, you're crocheting, I know somebody who crochets beanies and drops them off to the hospitals now because they've gotten really good at it from the pandemic. So we have to kind of look at some strength-based ways of processing the pandemic and the processing the losses and not getting so caught up on the 30-second clips that we see that then suppress the dopamine levels that we have and make us sad and make us feel like, you know, there's no resolution to this.
That's so true. And I think it's very much the definition of triggering that you watch that clip and like you describe, then everything that's coming up for you comes out. And I think because the numbers are so difficult to process and cope with, I think that's probably part of the reason why I find my walk so normalizing. Because sometimes you see the numbers and then you go around the corner and see there are still people walking around and you're like, oh no, it's not all over. You go to that worst case scenario in your head and you almost think, you can almost be surprised that people are just still going on runs and still thinking about their fitness and losing weight and all these actual concerns that we have the rest of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. The apocalypse statement was in itself, I mean, spot on, which is, yes, if we are in our houses and we are being filtered with just all of the negative stuff, the therapist in me sometimes wants to like scream at the TV, like, well, can y'all tell us how many people got healed from COVID? Can you please like throw that number out if you're going to throw out the additional number? And we rarely see it. So what happens is, you're right, it does become very triggering. It does become a gateway of being frantic. And so when we see people who are walking and jogging, still doing what they did before the pandemic, when we do see people FaceTiming, which is something we did before the pandemic, when we do see people like, hey, like, I'm still having a birthday, don't know what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna do something social distancing, we feel normal, right? Like, we feel like this is situational and that we're going through it versus we are at the beginning stages of it, or we're at the point where we don't have any answers. Like, we feel a little bit better. So I will also, part of that adaption plan too, is to make sure that you are decreasing the amount of, you know, negative thought process by filtering what you have through media and social media, and making sure that there's a good balance.
No, that's such a good way of putting it. It's getting rid of some of that negative stimuli and then trying to increase the little reminders that there are things left when it can feel like on the worst days that everything's over. And one of the ways that I've definitely tried to reduce the negative stuff is I just deleted the Facebook app. And, you know, I still go to look for it absentmindedly on my phone sometimes, but I've not yet felt the need enough to reinstall it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something I could recommend. Or even I hear other people recommend, just move the apps around. If you find yourself absentmindedly, like I do, going on Instagram all the time, well, maybe just put it in a different folder.
Mm-hmm.
And then you looking for it might be enough for you to think, actually, why did I really open my phone? It wasn't for this.
Yes, absolutely. If you could make it harder to access, then go ahead and remove it. Put it in two folders if you want. I know someone who has a monitor on how much social media that she gets to intake. And so her phone goes off when she's been on it for enough for the day. And she removes herself. She actually doesn't even have a TV. From what she's saying, she's like, yeah, I got rid of the TV too, because this is a way for her to center herself through books and through other platforms. And so everybody has something, right? Like, I'm not on Twitter, and I was told it's probably a good thing, only because people were getting into it with each other so much that it was then creating some stressors for that person. There are people who thrive on Twitter and they love Twitter, but they also filter what kind of Twitter accounts that they follow, what kind of people they engage with, if they keep their profile private, right? So you have options. And it's a good thing that we do have options, right? But yeah, I agree with you, right? If Facebook was your, I guess, instant gratification, if you want to think about it in that way.
I don't know why I spent so much time on Facebook, to be honest with you. I wasn't getting any news that I wasn't aware of. I was just getting people arguing about the news. And I think that's very social media, that it's so easy to go back and forth with somebody. And if you want evidence for that, just look at how badly people spell on Facebook, because they're just going back and forth and they care so much more about making their point than they do making their point appropriately or well. And so, of course, it spirals. Whereas by contrast, something you mentioned like a book, it's very slow form. You know, you can lose a whole day to a book and actually there's no breaking news in it. So it's a slower pace. It's a book that's been published 5 years ago. It's very unstimulating in a negative way.
So, yeah, those are kind of like some of my thoughts regarding, you know, trying to cope through the loss and trying to pour back into yourself and giving yourself some grace, but then also having some strength-based thinking to, you know, focus more on the more positive things.
It's really helpful. And you've made so many good suggestions, so I'm sure I'll pick up on even more of them when I listen back. It's very typical counselor of you, being able to fit so much information into very few words before the client thinks of something else to say.
Yeah, I try. Okay.
And so if people are interested in connecting with you, learning more about your work, maybe even looking for a new counsellor, where should they go?
Yeah, sure. So we are at Onyx Therapy Group. That is Onyx, just like the stone. So O-N-Y-X Therapy Group Our website is onyxtherapygroup.com. And my personal page is Chanel, C-H-A-N-E-L, like the perfume, _NO_6.
I was just looking at my notes for a second then being like, no, it's spelled with an S, I'm sure.
Yes. My name does start with an S, but you know, transparency. I had to kind of change my names on all social media platforms after I like actually became a therapist, because I was like, wow, you know, I like my clients, but I, you know, you guys are looking me up on social media. I'll get a request like ding ding, you know, like this person look you up, and then I have to have a convo about why we can't be social media friends and how unethical it is during the next session. So I just kind of like switched some stuff around so I'm not that findable.
I mean, fair enough. It's a real complicated thing. I know certainly my counsellor works in a different area to she lives, and that's part of the reason. And I know a lot of GPs and other professionals do that because of just what do you do in that situation? So some clients may find it very distressing to come across their counsellor and, oh, are they going to say something? Are they going to out that I'm seeing them?
Yes, but they could fully contact me on Onyx's page.
Grant. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating. If people want to hear more about grief, they can find the last episode we did with Sophie Savage, one of our all-time most popular guests. As I'm confident you may well be, because this has been great.
Yeah, of course. Invite me back if you have time.
Well, there's a challenge for the listeners. If you want her back, you let us know. Let us know what you want to hear about, and we'll figure something out. Thank you again.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.